Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 324. Thursday, January 17th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, Sea Realm Vault subscribers, thank you so much for subscribing. The January, I won't say flood, but the sort of pig in the python of Sea Realm support comes in January because, if you'll remember, this podcast started way back in the summer of 2012, and I gave it away for free, basically, to everybody who had ever made any financial contribution to the Sea Realm podcast for 6 months. So at the end of 6 months, I asked people to sign up, and it was either $8 a month or $80 for a year in advance. And a lot of people who chose $80, you know, for that year in advance, they signed up in January of 2013. Well, here we are 6 years later, and I think most of the people whose subscriptions renew, you know, their yearly $80 subscriptions renew in January, have been here since the beginning for 6 years. And that, to me, is amazing and wonderful. But I know, my Amazon Prime subscription renews sometime around the beginning of the year. It's coming up, I know. And there have been years when it has taken me by surprise. And, you know, it costs more than $80 now, but I think initially it was about $80. And sometimes, you know, that unexpected $80 charge really hurts. It really comes at a bad time. It leaves me, you know, short. So every January, that happens to some Sea Realm Vault subscriber who's got that annual subscription. And people feel, I don't know how they feel exactly. You know, when people make mistakes, one defensive reaction is to get mad. So, you know, every now and again in January, I will get that angry email saying, I didn't know this was an automatic renewal. You know, even in cases where it had renewed automatically on an annual basis three or four times, you know, the one time it caught them off guard, they say, well, I didn't expect this. I didn't authorize this. And, you know, rather than contacting me directly, sometimes people will just go to PayPal first. Please don't do that. I am so easy to work with when it comes to issuing refunds on Sea Realm Vault charges. Don't go to PayPal first. But thank you to everybody who subscribes. There won't be any more. Nobody, that annual subscription rate is no longer available for new subscribers. So everybody who's here under that plan has been here for a while, is pretty comfortable with it, but please know when your subscription renews so it doesn't hit you by surprise. And again, if you, like, just checking through your email, you can't find that initial notice or any past, you know, notice from PayPal saying that you were charged on this date. If you don't know when your subscription renews and you'd like to, you want to be aware, you want to put it on your calendar, or, you know, just be ready for it, feel free to contact me. I will look that up for you and let you know. So my email address, as I'm sure most of you know, is kmo@crealm.com. It amuses me. It shouldn't, but it amuses me. When people who have been listening to the Sea Realm podcast for years tell me that, you know, they couldn't find contact form on my website and they didn't know my email address, I guess they just tune it out because they've heard me read it out hundreds of times. KMO@crealm.com. And really, what else is it going to be? You know, KMO, that's me, @crealm.com. That's my website. It's the name of the podcast that you associate with me. That's my email address. So what you'll hear, at least in the first part of this episode, I mean, a good bit of it's just going to be me talking, as often is the case, but I recorded a conversation with my friend Doug. You've heard from him before. He and his mother, Bonnie, they are longtime supporters of the Sea Realm, and they lived here in Bellows Falls before Olga and I moved here. So they were my introduction to Bellows Falls. And Doug has got a lot of, you know, interesting things to say. He's a very smart guy. So he's somebody that I like to just go over to his house with a recorder, sit down and just start talking to him. And he's envious of, you know, the regular guests who have published books or something, which I have read, and I get to ask them questions, which I know they're ready to answer. Whereas with Doug, I just sort of turn the recorder on and I say, be interesting and entertaining, you know, which is a harder task. But he hasn't written the book, you know, so I can't treat him the way I do other guests. But I made this recording on New Year's Eve, and I had actually planned to record it and release it that same night, New Year's Eve, 2018. And I got back here, and I started listening to it, and there was some telltale sound artifacts on it, which, you know, I've gotten with digital recorders in the past when I've had them too close to cell phones. Well, this one I recorded with my phone. And I suspect that the recorder in the phone was picking up the radio signals that the phone itself was sending and receiving. I should have turned off my data, and I should have turned off Wi-Fi when I was there. But I got back here on New Year's Eve, and I started to listen to it, and the sound quality was bad. And I thought, well, I'm not going to use this. And to be honest, I had gotten some weed at Doug's, and I had gone a year without smoking, and I basically broke my abstinence, you know, my year of abstinence 4 hours before midnight, which is to say, rather than sit home late on a New Year's Eve and work on a podcast, I decided to get high instead. But, you know, I had started my weed fast a couple weeks before the beginning of the new year, so I did do a solid year plus abstinent. And in fact, as I will mention in the conversation with Doug, I just happened to make that particular New Year's resolution in the year when the state in which I live legalized recreational use of marijuana. So it had been legal in my home state for months before I ever took advantage of that. Anyway, I'm gonna play this. There are bits of it where you'll hear that electronic interference. To me, it is quite annoying. But, you know, here I am sort of investing my own self-worth in the audio quality of my podcast, which I know, you know, some of you will tune it out. For others, it will be annoying. But it was worst at the beginning. So I've actually cut out the first question that I asked Doug. I'm just going to start the recording with him answering it. But a couple weeks before I sat down with Doug to record that New Year's Eve conversation, he and I and Olga and Doug's mom and some other people we know, we all went to this restaurant here in town, which was, I don't understand quite what they were attempting to do, but they had set out like free eats, like good food, but in a separate room from the regular restaurant. And we could order drinks, and they would bring drinks to the table, and we could, you know, keep going back to the free food as much as we wanted. But we couldn't order off their regular menu there, which was an odd thing. So eventually we picked up and we moved over to the room next door and we ordered off the menu. But during the conversation, when we were just sampling the free eats and, you know, talking, Doug was telling his mother that taxes, the government does not collect taxes in order to pay for spending. In fact, it is the other way around. And really, the whole point of being draconian and just really hard on people, you know, who have failed to pay taxes or file their tax returns properly, that's not so much in the service of raising money, you know, for the operation of the government. That's more a means of social control, just to let the poor people know, look, we control you. You can't hide from us. So, you know, taxation, particularly the aggressive enforcement of taxation against poor people, where the government will spend more money to seize people's assets and, you know, their savings and whatnot than it's actually going to get from that action, that's not a money-raising revenue. That's an expenditure. It's an expenditure on social control. And I had asked Doug to reiterate that, you know, or just to restate it once the recorder was running. And that's the question he starts to answer before he veers off into something else. So that's where we are at the start of the conversation.
No, I mean, it's the other way around. You know, the taxation happens after the fact for different reasons. It's taxation is really more about, like, keeping inflation at bay is really what it's about.
How does that work?
Well, I mean, you know, basically the government first decides what it's going to pay for. It's going to pay for roads, military, social services, whatever. That money is created to pay for that stuff. And if the government didn't do anything, adding all that money into the economy would create a big inflationary problem. So the government has other means to sop up that money to ward off inflation is really the big reason it needs to be done, you know. And how it goes about getting that money out of the system is really bears no relation to what it's spending. It's more about creating incentives, disincentives, social engineering. There's lots of different reasons the government extracts money in the way that it does, you know. And income tax is, yeah, a really small percentage of that, you know, certainly. You know, there's lots of different taxes, you know, income tax, capital gains tax, you know, corporate taxes, you know. I mean, it is a lot of money, but I mean, there hasn't been a balance. There's been very few years where the United States has balanced its budget. You know, they're always
running. Since the Clinton administration.
Yeah, yeah, and that wasn't very long. It was just a couple years. I mean, if you look at the charts, I mean, it's just like it's off the charts. You know, except for this one little blip. You know, where there was a surplus. You know, and that was dangerous, right? I mean, that was to be avoided. That surplus was a problem, you know, in the economy. It was considered a problem. We had to do something about that. You know?
At the risk of alienating people by stating the obvious, I think for some people it's not obvious, the word inflation, for a lot of people, it just brings up the notion that prices get higher. But really what's inflating is the money supply. There's more money. That's what inflation means.
There's more money chasing the same amount of goods.
Right.
So everybody's willing to pay a little bit more for those goods, so the price of those goods goes up.
Right. But the price of the goods going up is not inflation, it's the effect of inflation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe technically, I don't know. I'm not an economist. I mean, certainly in my mind, inflation means rising prices. I mean, you know, I grew up, you know, in the, I was a child in the 70s. I remember gas prices, like, you know, for the first time, I mean, nothing like they've gone up since, but certainly at that time it seemed like crazy inflation, and there was a lot of inflation, and you know, the we went into a period where the interest rates were really, really high, you know. You know, there's been other, you know, that's what I think of as inflation, yeah. And then stagflation. I remember stagflation like being a word. The economy stagnating in the midst of all this hyperinflation. Not hyperinflation, but inflation.
And then a point from David Graeber in Debt: The First 5,000 Years. We tend to confuse talk of debt with talk of morality and say that, you know, paying one's debts is a moral duty, but really that only applies to poor people. That the debts of the rich are infinitely negotiable.
You know? And they don't bring any kind of moral judgment. You know, they're just when rich people, you know, owe 20, 30, 40 million dollars to the tax man, that's just, everybody just says, well, that they're doing business, you know, they just obviously did the right thing, and you know, it's, they're doing better to take that money and invest it on Wall Street than to worry about the penalties and such, because we all know the IRS penalties aren't really that high. The interest rate they charge is pretty reasonable, you know, it's actually a pretty good deal borrowing money from the IRS, yeah.
But if some schlub who doesn't know enough, you know, to lie sufficiently when doing his taxes ends up owing more than he can pay by, you know, $100 or so, the IRS will gladly spend $1,000 to collect that $200.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's kind of part of the trick with the IRS, as far as I've been able to tell, is you should never lie to them. There's no real need to lie. There's no real need to cheat them. There's no real need to, you know, I mean, that's when you start really getting in trouble, you know. If you just, you know, file and don't pay, then they, you know, start enacting these, you know, penalties, which are not really that high, and this interest rate, which is not really that high, and eventually you go into some sort of a dispute settlement situation with them, and you come up with a payment plan, which is extremely easy, and you get into that payment plan, and you, you know, I mean, like, Tim Geithner owed, you know, tens of millions of dollars and became the leader of the Fed. You know, I'm sure he was under a payment plan. It wasn't like that money was just sitting there. I'm sure he was totally attentive to that whopping tax bill. He just had a deal where he paid like $100 a month on it. I'm sure he just, you know, was totally up and up with them. Yeah. It's when you're not up and up with them, when you fail to, failure to file is like when the penalties really come in, you know, failure to file, filing in a pro, you know, incorrect information, boo, yeah, big, that'll really cost you, you know. But if you just get to the end of the year and you say, yeah, I owe you $100,000 and don't supply a check, you know, that doesn't really cost that much. That's not that expensive. Because rich people know to do that and know not to worry about that. Yeah. But they also, you know, the big thing is the audit, you know, and an audit is just, you know, a rounding error for a rich person and could be financially devastating for a poor person. You know. An audit can be very expensive, you know, in those terms. So that's really what it comes down to. But, you know, they just, it's really, there's so many poor people, right, first off, that they couldn't possibly really look at all that situation. So it's all algorithms. It's just a matter of like, you claimed this on this, and we think that's always suspicious. So you get one flag for that. And, you know, if you rack up another few flags, then someone's going to really look at you and then you'll be audited. You know, it's a matter of, you know, and you're, you know, poor people generally don't have accountants. Accountants know all these red flags. Accountants know exactly what the proper proportions are to avoid. You know, a big thing is self-employment. You know, when people are self-employed, when they're paying themselves through a corporation where they're the only person or whatever, you know, that there's opportunities there to screw the system. You know, you can take, because, you know, the money you make off the corporation is capital gains, much lower rate than the income you get off of it. And there's this rope to hang yourself with there. And, you know, if you have an accountant, the accountant's going to know a proper proportion, you know, based on whatever, your actual money flow or, you know, other extenuating circumstances. Same thing for, you know, deductions. You know, an accountant is going to know exactly what you can and can't claim, you know, and make sure that you claim everything. And a lot of people who don't use accountants try to claim things they shouldn't, you know. I mean, the car is usually the thing that people, poor people are getting in trouble for. You know, they have a car, they have a business, they can't run the business without the car, so they feel like the car is a business expense, but it's not if you do your groceries with it. That's just the way it works. And they, you know, mistakenly say, yeah, I get my groceries in it, and that's that, you know. Fuck, yeah, can't claim a car. And, you know, rich people just, like, it's not worth it to claim the car, you know. It's not that much of a savings. You know?
Did you hear that? I forget exactly what step she took, but Elizabeth Warren did something today, which has NPR, you know, saying over and over again that she's one step closer to running for president now.
I hadn't heard anything about it because I've been out of the news loop today. Yeah, thankfully.
So I, you know, when I get the news, usually it's in my flash briefing, I hear NPR headline news, and then I hear BBC headline news. So I got two takes on Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
And the BBC focused more on her claim to be Native American and Trump mocking her for that. But all in the context of, she's more likely now to be running for president than she was yesterday.
Of course she's going to run. Yeah. There's going to be 20 Democrats running, of course, because if there's not 20 Democrats, Bernie might win. And they're just absolutely doing anything they can to make sure Bernie doesn't win, which will mean running 20 candidates. It's astounding how he's just not visible in the media landscape, and yet he polls the number one politician in the country. Yeah.
Not among registered Democrats, he doesn't.
Really?
Really. Yeah, he's at the bottom of the list of actual registered Democrats. Democrats want Joe Biden. He's their man.
Democrats are idiots. I'd be interested to see that polling, though, because that surprises me. Are they that bitter? They're that bitter, the Democrats.
Well, you know, if you're a party loyalist, Bernie Sanders joined the party, you know, to run for president. He's been an outsider for a long time, and he's, you know, he never stopped identifying as a democratic socialist. The Democrats don't want to be called socialists.
Yeah, but he's closer to any Democrat than any Democrat. Yeah, closer to democratic ideals, stated ideals, than any Democrat's been in generations. So that's,
Right. So he's an outsider. He has a hostile ideology to the Democratic
But it's
Party.
It surprises me and depresses me that Democratic voters are that unaware of how screwed up their party is. I have not been following this stuff, honestly, because it's just too depressing how crazed everyone is about everything at this point. The Russiagate narrative is just, that's my new litmus test. If a media outlet doesn't have the right take on the Russiagate thing, I'm no longer listening to it. And it's caused me to lose a lot of media.
Who's got the right take?
It's really hard to find. The Zero Hour has the right take on it, for sure. They've had the... I mean, it's really... Aaron Matei has the take on it. He's really the journalist that has totally dug into the nitty-gritty of every last little bit of the Russiagate narrative.
And is it Aaron with an E or an Aaron with an A?
Aaron with an A. A-A, I guess. Aaron. Yeah. Yeah, guy.
M-A-T-E?
I think so. M-A-T-E. Yeah, Matei. He, until recently, was on The Real News, and he's no longer with them. And I don't know that he's really doing anything regular right now, like in terms of podcasting or being on YouTube or anything, which is a shame because he's really got again, he's got the take. Although he's since leaving The Real News, he seems to have been doing the rounds on all these other podcasts, which is great. I can kind of just search for Aaron Matei and he can find all these other podcasts that are featuring him and get a sense of other podcasts that are having a good sense of what's going on with all that.
I was pretty impressed with some of the stuff that The Intercept was doing and their podcast Intercepted. And then I tuned out for a while, and then I tuned back in, and Jeremy Scahill was just going full on Trump is a Nazi, not, it's not even a metaphor, like he's got a swastika on his sleeve, he really is a Nazi, and I'm like, wow, you went from doing pretty well to completely in the ditch.
That's really bad, yeah. We gotta stop calling him a Nazi when, like, there are people like Bolsonaro around. He really is a fascist, and we have to stop pretending that we're really there yet,
Yeah, because if we continue to move in that direction, if we've been at full Nazi, since 2016 or 2017, what further language do you use to describe a continued motion toward right-wing authoritarianism?
Absolutely, and it's really creating this opening for it. You're basically saying, here we are, we have been taken over by Nazis, and yet I'm going to the movie next Sunday, and I'm wondering what Britney Spears is up to or whatever. That stuff's still going on, so it's okay, with America if we get taken over by Nazis. That's fine,
I'll just vent about it on Twitter.
Yeah, that's, it's saying to the elite that is the case. These people think, if you're the elite and you're watching, Twitter and Facebook and everything, you're going to get the sense that, these people think they live under a fascist dictatorship and they're okay with it. So they're okay with a fascist dictatorship. Let's bring one on. We're really asking for it in a way, to frame it like that. But, there's so much craziness. This is on all sides at this point. It's hard to even talk about it sanely anymore.
I know that people listen to The Vault, some of them anyway, get irritated that I don't focus on the sins of Trump and his clan of pick your
gremlins.
Yeah, like I was gonna say
trolls. Troll is really a good word for all of them. They're all really troll like.
Actually, there is one listener that I hear from a lot who says, I don't know if he coined this term, but in my mind, he is the author of it, that Trump is our first troll president.
Troll president, yeah. Yeah, he looks
troll
like a troll
in the internet sense. Yeah. Just basically poking at people emotionally.
Oh, yeah, he's totally trolling. He trolls everybody. That's how he got to be president, is trolling the media.
So successfully.
Very successfully, yeah.
But it's totally in the media's interest to get trolled. I mean, they haven't...
Yeah.
I'd say they haven't wised up to, his methodology of trolling them, but maybe they have, and they just realize there's nothing to be gained by no longer, responding in a predictable way to his trolling.
And the money is an audience, and audiences love to be freaked out. And yeah, that's freakish stuff he says. You know, it's. I think also, I mean, there was weren't there emails in the stuff that ripped off from the DNC that they were pushing that in the beginning. You know, they really liked the idea of running against Trump. You know, they were afraid of running against someone like Jeb Bush. You know, they thought running against Trump would be an easy win. You know, so you know, we see clearly how much control, you know, there was, or how much, let's use that word, collusion there was between like CNN and the Hillary campaign and the DNC and all that. So yeah, I think that they really misunderstood. Mr. Trump and his approach.
Don't the Bush years seem so quaint now? The whole, like, my mental image of that whole period, that whole, like, 9/11 and the Gulf War.
It was pretty extreme, though. It wasn't quaint. It was pretty extreme. I mean, in a way, things are better now because, you know, at least the whole country isn't under a trance. I mean, they are kind of under a trance. It's a different trance. I think a better trance. I'd rather the country was all like in divided trances. That's kind of where we are now. We're in two different trances. Whereas, like, it was kind of scary when the whole country was tranced in the same way, you know?
I mean, post 9/11 security state fear trance?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in terms of like the things that were really damaging that were done, I mean, that's where we, you know, invaded two countries, and that's where we started all the surveillance or made it all very obvious. And, yeah, I mean, Trump is horrible, but what's the big legacy at this point? You know, I mean, if we're looking back like 10 years in the future and we're looking back at the Trump presidency, like, and we watch this, you know, terrible slide into fascism, I mean, you know, it was kind of worse what happened right after 9/11 in terms of like how many rungs down up that ladder we went, you know, down that road to fascism. I mean, Trump, you know, he brings it all to like just a more obvious, flagrant, you know, kind of level. He's, I mean, in a way, he is like reality TV star. He's like, let's get real about the fascist takeover. You know, it's a very reality TV show. Really, it's crazy.
Well, this is the final evening of 2018.
Yep, Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year. What do you think you'll remember? 2018. What image will you hang on this year?
I don't know. I've really been. It's been funny to listen to all these end of year review things and realize that I haven't heard about a lot of these things that happened. I've really been in my own little world, I guess. You know, I can't think. Nothing's coming to mind. Like my pool. That's what comes to mind. I finally got my pool sorted out. That's what happened in 2018. No, I guess, you know, the midterms, you know, I guess is something that is sticks in my head. You know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that's probably the thing that will stick in my mind about 2018, you know, in terms of like events. You know, I can remember sitting very distinctly you know, watching her win the, sitting at a cafe, opening up the New York Times and seeing that she had won, you know, the primary.
Were you in New York at the time?
No, I was in a cafe here, and I was just like, but it was the New York Times, and I was like, kind of blown away. I really didn't. I just heard of her, you know, a few days earlier. You know, she's running. Maybe it'll happen. You know, blah blah. I was like, ah, oh, yeah, right. And she won. So yeah, that's probably a defining memory.
My life, 2018, looked a lot like 2017.
I mean, there was some horrific online things. You know, 2018 was the year that Grindr gave HIV status information to all of its advertisers. That was a pretty big. That'll probably go down in my memory. That was pretty flagrant and outrageous data abuse.
Right now, the stock market is down.
Yeah.
And I heard a story just before I came over here, and I learned a new acronym. Is FANG. You know FANG?
FANG.
Facebook, Apple, what's the N?
Oh, the NB, Google,
yeah,
and Netflix.
Yes, you're right. Yes, Netflix. And a lot rides on those stocks. If the tech stocks are down, the whole market is down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the whole, yeah.
And, you know, outfits like Facebook are down for very good reason. I mean, the magnitude of their malfeasance is still coming to light.
They've been heading down for a while. They've lost a lot of value, you know. It's funny as the economy is all like, you know, looking, heading towards a downturn. It was wild that for a brief moment, Amazon hit $1 trillion valuation. Just a brief moment. We had $1 trillion company for a minute.
Was that in 2018?
That just happened last week.
Oh, last week. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
That's very, yeah. It was just for a bit. It could happen again. I mean, they could bounce back up there again, but. Maybe in January. And everybody seems to think we're going to get some little rebound in January. And then more of a downturn, and then the Fed has to start spending money. That seems to be what all the different economic doomer gurus have to say in their year-end summations.
I haven't read any of those. I'll have to.
I haven't gotten through them all.
I think, actually, I did read John Michael Greer's, but John Michael Greer's are usually pretty tame. He basically says, you know, no catastrophic doom this year. The stores will still be open at the end of the year. People will still be interested in sports. You know,
yeah, he basically says, you know, this time next year, things will be pretty much the same, but have declined yet another little bit, you know. Sometimes he says, though, that you know, this will be a bigger stair step than other years. You know? Did he say that this year? I think he said that last year.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he... Because he also very wonderfully critiques his previous year.
Yes.
Which I think is... I wish all of them would do that. So we get to see how well he called it. I guess another thing I would really think about this year is GDPR. That had played a lot of in my life. And, you know, could be important.
GDPR?
GDPR, yeah. The European law, privacy law, data management law that greatly affected me and my business because we had to support the things that it dictates. Like, for instance, and I guess everybody should know this, you know, because pretty much all the social sites like Facebook and Tinder and Google and blah, 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 they are all supporting GDPR. Most of them internationally, even though they really by law only have to support it in Europe for European citizens. But it's really hard to know where European citizens are. So it's much easier to just make this possible for all people. And the law specifies things like you need to be able to delete your account and your information really has to be deleted. You know, you can also do a dump of your data, all your data. And theoretically, you're supposed to produce all the data for the person, you know, that's how we've implemented it. You know, it was very hard to implement. It took us months and months to implement it, but we really, you know, went far beyond, you know, really the letter of the law to make sure that we were doing a full delete and a dump. And you know, so there's other kind of more like recommendations in the law that we're still implementing, things like surfacing the reasons why you're presenting things to people, you know. So
what does surfacing mean?
Making it apparent somehow in the user interface why it is that recommendations, for instance, are being made to you, you know. A lot of sites already do this. You know, you'll go, because you watched blah, 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 here's blah, blah, blah. You know? that's surfacing. You know, it's showing you the links between what you did to cause them to think that you would like to do that again or would like something similar or, you know.
So I guess it's the lack of surfacing that had so many people convinced that Facebook was using the microphones in their phones to listen to every piece of their conversation because... Some of the recommendations they were getting were so spot on, people were thinking, oh, they must be spying on me. Well, yeah, they are spying on you, but not in the gross way that you imagine.
They could be.
No.
I mean, I think if you look through it, Facebook in particular has ridiculous terms of service. And I think that there's nothing stopping them actually from engaging your microphone and your camera without your consent. I mean, they have to kind of, the language of these click-through agreements is kind of necessary because sometimes, you need to do that. The user wants to record in the middle of your app, so you need to get permission to do that recording. But, of course, the language is always so nonspecific that it doesn't really cover uninitiated user, where the user hasn't actually initiated the recording, for instance. But they certainly could. I don't know that they are. I have no idea. But
I don't believe they are.
I mean, the idea with GDPR is ultimately they would, be obliged to surface all the information that they have on you. So if they, theoretically, users in the if it turned out that users in Europe were making GDPR data dump requests from Facebook and Facebook was actually recording their conversations and did not include that in their data dump, there's legal trouble there, So, we should imagine and hope that Facebook is trying to follow the laws of Europe and implement them the same around the world.
Do you have any interaction whatsoever with the so-called new tech platforms, like the new social media platforms like Gab.ai and Minds.com? And
no, you probably know a lot more about those things because you've kicked yourself off Facebook.
I didn't kick myself off. But I didn't make any grand effort to, come crawling back to them either.
Right. No, I haven't really.
That'll be my 2018, thing I hang on it, though, is my last year on Facebook.
Yeah, that was your last year on Facebook. Yeah, or at least the year you first got off Facebook. Put it that way. You might be back on. Who knows? Facebook could change, I mean, if Facebook, Bernie Sanders wins and he nationalizes Facebook and turns it into, something the government runs, you might come back, right?
Well,
if it was a public utility.
Yeah. I don't see that happening, but sure.
It could happen.
I mean, maybe he'll nationalize MySpace and I'll go back to MySpace.
Facebook's land to get. But, those are hopeful things, I think a lot of, certainly in the dating space, and which is the space I'm involved in, I think it could be a learning experience for people to get a sense of why the people that are being recommended to them are being recommended to them. Because, a lot of people say and perhaps think and talk about their certain interests and blah, blah, blah. And then, these algorithms find other interests and it might be helpful for them to see how they came upon those. And ultimately, I think that the legislation hints at, controlling, the people should be able to control this. They should be able to override the automated settings, I think there is actually language in there. They should be able to turn it off so that they don't get recommendations, but that seems like wasn't really thought out because, I mean, what good is Netflix if they're not making recommendations? What are you going to see? You're just going to, I guess a search box is all you're allowed, if you're not, because that is their entire UI is recommendations. So certainly a lot of dating sites are like that.
I think another thing, 2018 will be in my memory is the year that Vermont legalized marijuana.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And the year I didn't smoke any.
And the year you didn't smoke any. It's very silly. The very year where it became legal to do so.
Yes. The year which ends in just a few hours' time.
Yeah.
And also, it's the year that the Trump administration shed itself of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, who was a strong holdout for a renewed drug war.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's got Jared Kushner whispering in his ear saying, prison sentencing reform, mass incarceration, free the prisoners. So
cool. The Trump presidency may wind up being not the end of the world. I mean, didn't I say this in 2014 or something that I thought that there was a chance that because he is such a shallow personality and I think, is really susceptible to the people's will that way. He wants to be popular, and he might wind up, doing some populist things, that might actually be just what we needed. Hard to know. I mean, obviously he's doing a lot of other things that are very damaging, but always politics is a matter of taking the good with the bad, right? Never in my life of looking at politics has there been a period where there was just a bunch of good stuff happening. It's always bad stuff and good stuff, and usually more bad stuff than good stuff. So really, we should be happy with any good stuff happening, especially anything fundamental. You know?
I've been looking forward to the end of the drug war for decades. And it seems like there's not going to be a day when it happens. They're going to slowly, over years and possibly decades, one state at a time, one plant at a time, you know, even in smaller steps than that, even, that it's slowly, they're slowly going to back away from it.
Which I don't think they'll ever, you know, actually legalize all drugs. You know, there's just too much value in the social control. You know, and there's too... It's too divvied up in terms of who's doing what drugs. You know, there's just certain cultures, certain groups of people are doing certain drugs, and that's just too tempting, I think, for politicians to not utilize. I don't know. Maybe it could come about through the healthcare collapse of the healthcare system. You know, you might find that it's, you know, prescription drugs that are actually, at the end of the day, forcing the total allowance of all drugs, just because, you know, as things collapse, there are going to be a lot of rich people needing certain drugs. And, you know, if things aren't available, you know, they're going to get them and they're not going to want to get in trouble for it. And, you know, who knows? I don't know.
Well, rich people have never had much to fear from the drug war.
No.
I mean, in the 80s, for like 10 minutes, Ronald Reagan made a point of saying, we're going to seize the property of, you know, rich people in Florida. Your employees smoked a joint on your yacht. We're going to take your yacht.
Yeah.
It didn't last.
I remember that.
Yeah, civil asset forfeiture is huge, but it's not directed at the rich.
No, it's not. It's taking people's clunker cars from them, you know, because they happen to have a joint somewhere in the ashtray.
I mean, to be fair, they're more likely they were engaged in some sort of, you know, drug commerce, but... you know.
I don't think they have to be.
No, they don't.
I mean, that's a big, you know, money-making operation for a lot of police departments in this country, confiscating shit from people.
Yeah.
Alrighty, that was my friend Doug. Given his job, given the work that he does and the sector that he's in, of course, GDPR, that is General Data Protection Regulation, European Union Regulation on the Processing of Personal Data, that's definitely a big thing in his life, and I had never heard of it until I sat down to talk to him about 2018. And, you know, I listen to a lot of what its detractors would call alt-right, but which I would just call anti-establishment media, and a lot of them are very hard on the EU. Largely because its governing bodies are mostly unelected and unaccountable to the people. So it's largely an anti-democratic project. But that in and of itself, I mean, I don't use the word democratic as a synonym for right and proper. You know, there are matters which it makes sense to let, you know, bureaucrats, let's call them that, people who specialize in a certain types of governing system or a certain type of... you know, regulatory apparatus. There are instances where it makes a lot more sense to let elite specialists make decisions about regulation than it does to put everything to a vote, you know, to give the plumbers and the podcasters of the world their say in determining, you know, how government will be administered. And then there's the whole immigration thing. There are factions in the EU which seemed dead set on swamping their native populations with transplants from a culture which will not be easily assimilated, you know, into European culture. But on the topic of the rights of the individual in relationship to the big tech companies, I think that Europe is way ahead of the United States. I think the United States is clearly ahead of China in that respect, but you don't want to have to be compared to China in order to be, you know, judged favorably, particularly on the topic of protection of the individual. So a few more things. I just listened to the conversation with Doug, and I was tempted to cut out every time, you know, that electronic interference started, but we would have lost things that I wouldn't have wanted to try to summarize. So I've left those in there. But Elizabeth Warren, wow. Have you seen her Get Me a Beer video? She's not saying to somebody, get me a beer. She's saying, I'm going to go to the fridge and get me a beer. She's trying to adopt a folksy dialect in order to be relatable. But, you know, she is a law professor who has taught at elite educational institutions, the elite institutions where the elite send their kids, you know, to make the right connections to get ahead in the world. That is her strength. That is, given that she is familiar with those circles, that is her qualification for high office, not her ability to, you know, say, oh, I'm going to go and get me a beer out of the fridge and have this folksy conversation with you on Instagram. Paul Joseph Watson, who is, you know, the saner part of the InfoWars brand, roasted her alive, basically just dragged her over the coals for that. And, you know, I laughed my ass off as I was watching that Paul Joseph Watson video. She really set herself up to be mocked as a completely tone-deaf, clueless elite who, in trying to appeal to the masses, you know, vastly underestimates their sophistication and alienates them in the process. I mean, if this, who advises Democrats to behave this way? You know, if you are at home in the precincts of power, then that is your qualification for operating in those precincts. To suddenly turn around after a career as, you know, a professor of law at elite educational institutions, to then turn around and try to run your campaign on the, you know, oh, I'd like to have a beer with her mentality, which arguably, you know, got George Bush and Donald Trump into office, but is not going to get Elizabeth Warren into office. Come on. I mean, did she think of that on her own, or was she advised to do that? Don't get me wrong. There's a lot to like about Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, given a choice between her, Trump, or a protest vote, I would probably choose Elizabeth Warren. Hopefully I'd be choosing her as the VP on the Sanders Warren ticket, but, you know, not holding out any hopes on that one. And something, you know, I heard myself say in the recording, which I had an experience last night, which really cast that in a new light. I said, don't the Bush years seem quaint now that we're in this really crazy time? And I liked what Doug said. You know, right now we're in this, the particular brand of craziness that has seized us is competing brands of craziness. You know, domestic tribalism, whereby we really, really, really hate the people who don't share our opinions. And, you know, we make the most uncharitable assumptions about their motivations and their character. But, you know, decade and a half, no more than that, gosh, close to two decades ago now, you know, right after 9/11, we were all, not all of us, but enough of the country that I can say, you know, the majority of people were all under the same spell. It was a uniting spell. It was a, we are under attack, we will unite, and we will support our leader in whatever he wants to do, you know, in retaliation. Last night, Olga and I went down to Brattleboro, to the historic Lachis Theater, and we saw Vice, the new film by Adam McKay. Adam McKay, who is the writer and director of The Big Short. So this is a biopic about Dick Cheney. It's the one in which Christian Bale gained a whole bunch of weight in order to play Dick Cheney. And man, he does a great job. I mean, I totally bought Christian Bale as Dick Cheney. There were times when I just couldn't even see Christian Bale there, largely because he had gained so much weight. It just didn't look like him. But at the same time, Sam Rockwell, whom I absolutely love, plays W, you know, George W. Bush in this film. And there were only instances, just, you know, little short periods of time when I could actually see him as George W. Bush and not just see him as Sam Rockwell. And the same was true of Steve Carell playing Donald Rumsfeld. I just saw him as Steve Carell. I would remember that he's playing Donald Rumsfeld, but he just doesn't look like Donald Rumsfeld. He didn't sound like Donald Rumsfeld, you know, so I couldn't really hold in mind that he was Donald Rumsfeld, except, you know, at a very abstract intellectual level. But Christian Bale as Dick Cheney, damn, totally bought it. It is well worth your time to go see that film. But, You know, when I say, oh, don't the Bush years seem quaint? You know, this film follows him, and it's non-linear. So it's jumping in, like it starts, I was going to say in the present, but it's not the present anymore. That's almost 20 years old. It starts basically when Dick Cheney is acting as president in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and basically telling George W. Bush over the phone, you know, you just stay in hiding. I'll run the show. You don't worry about it. And Condoleezza Rice is sitting, you know, at the same table as Dick Cheney, just looking horrified that the vice president is running the country, you know, in this moment of crisis, and telling the president to stay out of the way. That's where the film opens. But then, you know, it jumps back in time to the 60s when Dick Cheney is a young man. And basically, you know, he's a drunk and a rabble rouser and he's going nowhere in life. And it is his wife, or then girlfriend, I guess, Lynn Cheney, who basically sits him down after bailing him out of jail for, you know, after he was arrested for drunk driving, and telling him, look, you are going to straighten up and you are going to be somebody. You know, you're going to stand up and make an impression on this world as a functioning adult, or I'm gone. And there are several moments in the film where the filmmakers seem to be saying, look, if it weren't for Lynn Cheney basically holding him up, pointing him in the direction she wants him to go and pushing him, and then saying, good boy, good boy, good boy, every time he does something, you know, to advance his career, that we never would have had a Vice President Dick Cheney. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But that's the impression that the film gives. So it jumps around back and forth, but it's largely linear, you know, in that it's moving from his youth into his the beginning of his political career and then into middle age. And then, you know, it skips a long piece of his life where he's not really in politics at all. He's just the head of Halliburton, and then comes back to, you know, the beginning of the Bush presidency. Or really, it comes back to George W. Bush wooing Cheney, trying to get Cheney to be his vice presidential candidate in the campaign. And the film is really enjoyable up to this point, you know, because one, it's just, it's a really competently crafted film. Two, I didn't know a whole lot about the background of Dick Cheney. I mean, I knew what positions he had held in previous administrations, but I didn't know a whole lot about, you know, his personal life or the exact role that his mentors had played in bringing him into, you know, the mainstream of, actually, he was never really mainstream. I mean, he was the king neocon, you know, the neoconservative. But as the film is teaching me things, I was really engaged with it and then enjoying it. But then we got up to the 2000 election and I was just like sighing, you know, audibly, and just like, oh God, I have to relive the god-awful fall of 2000 with, you know, the hanging chads and the Supreme Court and the lawsuits. And, you know, we're a good hour into the film at this point, and I thought, please, please don't make us relive every excruciating turn of the Bush administration and the Iraq War and the War on Terror and, oh, God. So when I was faced with the prospect of having to revisit, you know, every scandal of the Bush White House, My comment about, oh, don't the Bush years seem quaint now, really came back to bite me in the ass, because no, they don't seem quaint. They were really pretty terrible. And I'm glad I don't have to relive them. And wow, isn't it weird that we are almost two decades into the 21st century? Doesn't it seem like we just got here? It's a fifth over, almost. Anyway. Aaron Maté. I had never heard of him before, or if I had, it didn't make an impression. I still haven't taken in any of his stuff, but I have found a YouTube interview that he did with Robert Wright. Robert Wright is an author whose work I have enjoyed for many years. Probably, I'm going to say probably best known for his book, Non-Zero. He wanted to call the book Non-Zero Sumness, which his publisher said was a profoundly ugly word. But, you know, a zero-sum contest, or a zero-sum interaction, is where you have a clear winner and a clear loser. And a non-zero-sum interaction is where everybody benefits for being a party to the interaction. And his whole point is that civilization and technological civilization and technological capitalist civilization, they continuously expand the sphere of non-zero-sum interactions. So this is somebody that, you know, I formed a positive opinion of him long before I ever encountered the peak oil meme. I know to some of you, based on just how I've described him just now, he's a techno-utopian and somebody who you can completely write off as being, you know, fantasy-based and not worth listening to. And I think you'd be mistaken to do that. But I did find a hour, I think it's an hour and a half long conversation between Aaron Maté and Robert Wright on the topic of Russiagate. I haven't listened to it yet. I'm hoping to do that this weekend as I'm working on the comic strip. All right. And finally, I've saved this one for last just in case I completely go off the rails in, you know, venting my spleen on this issue. Today is the season 2 premiere of Star Trek Discovery on CBS All Access, a streaming service where you pay a monthly fee and they still show you commercials. If you want the commercial-free version, you have to upgrade to their bigger package. And CBS All Access is largely a complete financial debacle and failure for CBS. But what little glimmer of success it has come from the fact that Star Trek Discovery doesn't air on CBS TV, thanks to Leslie Moonves, the now disgraced and ousted Leslie Moonves. Instead, it is only to be shown on their streaming service. And so, you know, the Trekkies, myself included, last year, dutifully signed up to pay the money so we can watch our one show on a streaming service. Can you imagine signing up for a streaming service to watch 4 hours a month of TV? Anyway, I did that last year. And I know that, you know, because this year, last week, CBS All Access offered a free week for anybody who wanted it. You know, they could sign up and they could binge watch the first season of Star Trek Discovery in order to then, you know, sign up monthly and watch season 2. And almost nobody took advantage of it. And when I say almost nobody, you know, in a nation of 300 million people, they were getting signups in the double and triple digits each day. And in season 1 of Star Trek Discovery, basically Netflix put up the money for the production, and CBS was spending $8 to $10 million per episode. That's roughly the same budget as each episode of Game of Thrones. And updating Star Trek for the Game of Thrones audience was explicit, you know, in the talking points that CBS was throwing around in the development process of the show. And Netflix paid that money for the first season. And Star Trek Discovery isn't even on Netflix in the US, but, you know, in the US, it's only available through CBS All Access, but in the rest of the world, it was available on Netflix. And the fans, you know, longtime Star Trek fans were angry with the product. Netflix was very unhappy with CBS for the product that was delivered. And so for season 2, Netflix really scaled back what they were, you know, putting up to cover the production costs. So now CBS has a lot more skin in the game, and they have to see a lot of return on their investment, or Star Trek Discovery will be gone. And Star Trek Discovery, which is basically, you know, the Kelvin timeline, the J.J. Abrams bad robot Star Trek movies brought to the screen, you know, in terms of the aesthetic sensibility with lots of explosions and shaky cams and lens flares and, you know, very little of what longtime Star Trek fans return to Star Trek for, you know, which is intelligent investigation of things which aren't really plausible in terms of their exact depiction on screen, but, you know, they're indicators of problems, moral problems, technical problems, sociological problems that humans can encounter as we introduce more technology into our lives and into our civilization. We get, you know, in the past, we got thoughtful explorations of these topics on Star Trek. And now on Star Trek, aside from a whopping dose of social justice propaganda, you know, we get a lot of just flash, bang, profanity for its own sake, just for shock value. And really lazy, lazy storytelling. Not just lazy, but incompetent. Like, there are regular characters on the show, bridge officers that we see episode after episode, and after an entire season, I couldn't even tell you their names. I'm not sure their names were ever mentioned. And I've seen these characters in the trailers for season 2. I mean, they're still around. They are still regular characters. But because of the way the show tells its stories, I don't know who they are. I don't know a thing about them. I don't have any clue as to what their personalities are. All I know is, you know, each one of them has some physical descriptor that I could appeal to. Like one looks like a robot and another looks like she's got some, you know, neuroprosthetic on her head. So my dear hope, and there is lots of reason to think that this will happen, is that Alex Kurtzman, you know, the bad robot, J.J. Abrams' protege, who is currently the God Emperor of Star Trek at CBS, he and bad robot are going to be out the door. The whole CBS TV bad robot production company, you know, marriage will dissolve, and the monstrous children of that marriage, specifically Star Trek Discovery and hopefully strangled in its cradle, the new Picard series, will just, you know, go down the memory hole and just be an enduring lesson of really irresponsible management of a beloved intellectual property. But my dilemma is this. I'm really invested in this topic, as you can tell. I know that watching the show is going to make me angry. And why would I watch something that's going to make me angry? Why would I pay to watch something that's going to make me angry? There's a curiosity, a sort of morbid curiosity aspect to this, but there's also just the desire to be part of the ongoing conversation that takes place on social media and on YouTube and, you know, various places. And I want to be able to weigh in or to at least understand enough of what somebody is talking about to decide whether I agree or disagree with them. So Star Trek Discovery Season 2 premieres tonight on CBS All Access, and I am still undecided as to whether or not I'm going to take in that content, and if I do, whether I am going to pay CBS for it, because really I want Bad Robot Star Trek dead. I want it dead, and I don't want to do anything that might prolong its life in the slightest. Specifically, giving money to CBS. But at the same time, if I'm going to watch it, it seems like I should accept the full responsibility for watching it, which means giving that little bit of support to CBS for their bad robot Star Trek. I did a video about this where I said basically the same thing, but not quite at such length. I tend to be a little bit more concise on the daily YouTube videos. Although sometimes I ramble and I change topics and I go off in a direction that I hadn't planned to. And what usually happens is that at the end of, you know, however long I spend talking into the camera, I realize that more than saying stuff I didn't plan to say, I didn't cover most of what I had planned to say. But, you know, uploading daily, it's not any source of stress for me. I know I'm going to have the opportunity to say it again. And I know in order to avoid being misunderstood, either deliberately or, you know, honestly, I will have to repeat myself on certain topics. So, you know, I've made peace with the higher repetition required on YouTube than in a podcast like this. Also, you know, the podcast audience is one that has been with me in many cases for over a decade. And it's a very friendly audience, even when we disagree. You know, the communications that I have with C-Realm podcast listeners and C-Realm Vault listeners are enjoyable. I mean, they're always friendly messages, even when people disagree with, you know, positions that I've staked out on the podcast, which is great. Whereas with the YouTube videos, you know, I'm largely talking to people who don't know me. And here's just some guy on YouTube saying something that I dislike. I am just going to unload on this guy and just say all manner of just really unjustified, crass, you know, vulgar things to somebody I don't know. So it's very strange to have a sort of antagonistic relationship with a portion of my audience, you know, a portion of the YouTube audience, which right now is still very small, still have fewer than 700 subscribers, I think, at this point. I think doing the daily videos, I am going to break 1,000 this year, but that's not the goal. I did a video about this as well. The goal is to produce content and to find a streamlined production process and also an on-camera persona. Basically, everything that I want out of my daily YouTube videos is going to come from me. It's not going to come from YouTube. It's not going to come from the audience. This is a challenge that I have set for myself to bring forth qualities in myself that I think will be useful, not only for YouTube, but also for the podcast and basically for everything I do. It's all of a piece. And that said, let me put out the usual plea to please come and read the comic strip. It is free to you. I get paid to do it. But the more people who access it, the closer we get to moving to the next stage. And the next stage is going to be animation, which I'm very interested in getting into that. I want to provide some of the voice work myself and, you know, character design. I enjoy creating the characters. I enjoy designing the characters and depicting them. I don't really enjoy being an illustrator, which is ironic given how much time in my life I have spent, you know, I have devoted to becoming a competent illustrator. Had I gone back in time and told my my 15-year-old self, yeah, you want to draw comics for a living? You won't like it. If you get the exact job you want, you won't like it. You would rather be doing something else. Trust me. I don't believe my teenage self would have believed my 50-year-old self on that topic. All right. Well, this is not my first podcast of 2019, although given that, you know, I've played something from 2018, it seems like I should say something about the beginning of 2019. And I've, you know, as I say, I think I mentioned in the conversation with Doug, my intake of mainstream news content is greatly diminished. I'm just so irritated with what I think of as the mainstream media, which is really mostly NPR and BBC. But I'm so irritated with them, you know, over cultural issues right now that I just can't stand to listen to much of it, which consequently means I'm living more in a filter bubble in one respect, but also more just of a local, I don't want to say solipsistic exactly, but you know, because I am dealing with local people. I'm dealing with other people around me. But my life, in spite of an overt rejection of the peak oil mentality and associations with the peak oil community, my life is much more local than it has been in a while. It's more locally focused. And largely that means that I am not paying attention to a lot of the larger issues which dominate the mainstream conversation, the one that, you know, people who watch Fox News or MSNBC or CNN, the things that are recognizable to them as the topics of the day, the current subject matter to be deliberated upon and commented upon. I'm more and more tuned out from that than I think I've ever been in my whole life, largely because I just cannot stand to listen to NPR or the BBC anymore. And this should be a topic for a completely different podcast, but I will give it like the 3-minute pass. The mainstream media, and again, for me, that largely means NPR and the BBC, but NPR in particular has been really hysterical about Donald Trump accusing the mainstream media of being an enemy of the people. Donald Trump's criticism is of the actual existing media. And every response or refutation of his claim that I have read or heard has been a defense of the free press as an abstract idea. Well, I've never heard Donald Trump criticize the idea of a free press. What I have heard him criticize is the actual institutions which govern the behavior of the gathering and the reporting of news, choosing which stories to present, which to ignore, which to actively quash, which to distort, and how. You know, it is the actual media which has a lot to answer for. And so every time I hear somebody first replay or reference Donald Trump saying that the media is the enemy of the people, and then launching into a defense of the abstraction of a free press, to me, that is blatantly dishonest and self-serving, and it makes it really difficult for me to take seriously anything else that comes out of that same news outlet that day, that week, that year, really. I mean, if the media is systematically blind to or just refuses to admit that it has interests and that its interests are not simply unbiased reporting, but that they have aligned themselves with certain aspects of our civilization, certain aspects of our society, and against, deliberately, overtly against others, you know, if they can't admit that very basic information about the reality of their operation, then it's just, I don't know why I would try to make the effort to take them seriously on other topics. Okay, I'm sure that's 3 minutes. I could go on that one for a while, but I won't. Okay, I am going to stop recording and start the editing, and we'll see how much of what I've said here remains in the final podcast. Possibly most of it. We'll see. As always, if anything I have said here sparks an idea, a thought, anything that you want to share with me, please do so. Unless you state otherwise, any communication that comes to me that references the content of this podcast, I consider it, you know, possible material to be used in the podcast. So if you do not want your comments shared with the larger CRealm audience, make that explicit. And again, if you don't know when your CRealm Vault subscription renews, it is a good idea to know that. I will be happy to look it up for you. So send me email, kmo@c-realm.com. All right. Thank you for listening. And as always, thank you for subscribing. I know it's not exactly the new year, but happy new year. And I wish you, honestly, success, abundance, engagement, fulfillment, joy, all the good stuff for 2019. Stay well.